This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, January 27, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, a new government group vows to crack down on mortgage fraud and help families facing foreclosure. Wisconsin's legislature votes to weaken rules that could pave the way for a huge iron mine, but the move is drawing resistance. And the Iraqi government vows to pursue justice after a Marine charged in the 2005 Haditha killings of Iraqi civilians avoids jail time. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Mumia Abu-Jamal has been transferred to the general prison population for the first time in 3 decades. Supporters celebrated last month when the Philadelphia DA's office announced it would no longer seek the death penalty in his case. Prison officials transferred Abu-Jamal from death row to a restricted housing unit where he was kept in solitary confinement for the past 7 weeks. The Department of Justice has been cracking down on state-run mental institutions nationwide. Virginia, which operates 5 of these facilities called training centers, came under scrutiny early last year and has now reached a settlement with the federal government. FSRN's Brad Kuttner has the story from Richmond.
It's being called a victory by advocates for the intellectually disabled in Virginia.
People have been in institutions for many, many years. This will be the first time that they're living in a home, in a neighborhood, going to a job or a meaningful day activity in an integrated community-based setting. Just having the opportunities of what the ARC calls a life like yours.
Jamie LeBon, ARC of Virginia's executive director, is excited because of the $2.1 billion settlement between the state of Virginia and the Department of Justice. The agreement will lead to the closing of all but one of the state's training centers. After a DOJ investigation exposed mistreatment of patients and the high cost of institutionalization, Virginia will move thousands of residents into their families or group homes. But LeBon says the settlement, which will fund placement for 300 additional people per year for 10 years, still doesn't meet the needs of the state. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
Bloodshed continued in Syria today as the UN Security Council considers possible action against the regime. International media report that nearly 40 people died in fighting. A video posted on YouTube shows the bodies of 4 children who, the account owner claims, were killed in Homs by security forces. A secret 15-page worst-case Fukushima contingency plan by the Japanese government has emerged. The document is raising further questions about transparency after the government initially denied the meltdown of 3 reactors, as well as questions about whether the government would have been able to handle a full meltdown situation. FSRN's Claudia Craig reports.
Suppressed until now to contain panic, the March 2010 Japan Atomic Energy Commission report, compiled for then-PM Naoto Kan, planned for total evacuation within 105 miles of the plant. Under this scenario, 40 million people, including those living in Tokyo, would be displaced for decades. At the time, PM Kan said he had not concealed any facts from the public, despite being in possession of the unreleased contingency plan. The government also strongly maintained, while denying the meltdown, that there was no need for further safety measures. But the report suggests broader precautions were needed. An internal investigation into possible government cover-ups has now been launched. Claudia Craig, FSRN.
The government of India has renewed calls on Olympics officials to decline sponsorship from Dow Chemical because of the company's link to the Bhopal gas disaster 25 years ago. FSRN Shreya Niazi has the latest.
The Indian Olympic Association is demanding that London Olympics organizers remove Dow Chemicals as a sponsor of the upcoming games. In a letter to International Olympics Committee and the London Organizing Committee, Indian officials said there is growing international opposition to the sponsorship. On Thursday, Meredith Alexander, the ethics commissioner of the Commission for a Sustainable London, resigned in protest of Dow's involvement in the games. She spoke with Amnesty International.
The commission was asked to look at whether or not that was appropriate, given this promise to be the most sustainable games ever. And unfortunately, I feel that the commission ended up becoming an apologist for Dow Chemicals.
Olympic officials in India say Alexander's resignation is a vindication of their principal stand. Shreya Niazi, FSRN, India.
This week, Brazilian police invaded a settlement of landless workers near the capital, Sao Paulo. Authorities evicted an estimated 1,500 families from their homes. For nearly 8 years, the workers have been occupying the land, which is owned by a bankrupt property company. From Brazil, Deborah Pill reports.
Nearly 2,000 police in helicopters and steel-plated cars on Sunday conducted the early morning raid on the settlement known as Pinheirinho. Police used rubber bullets and pepper spray and ordered families to leave their homes. There have been unconfirmed rumors of deaths. Residents have been fighting for 8 years to stay in the area. The federal government was on their side, but the state government was pushing for eviction. Last week, the federal government, mayor and state government tried to find a peaceful solution to the conflict. The process was still underway when the state decided to launch the operation. Amnesty International is pushing the Brazilian government to find housing for the displaced families, many of whom were being housed in local gymnasium. Deborah Pio, Free Speech Radio News, São Paulo.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Senegal, residents defied a ban on protests and are demonstrating ahead of an expected court ruling on whether President Abdoulaye Wade will be permitted to run for a third term. The West African country will hold presidential elections next month, and in the lead-up to the vote, human rights and civil society groups have condemned what they call a government crackdown on opposition leaders. The showdown about who will be on the ballot is the latest in the election process. For more, we go to FSRN reporter Alpha Jallo, who is in Dakar. He joins us by cell phone. Alpha, good to have you on.
Thank you very much.
You're there on the streets in Dakar. Describe the scene at the demonstrations.
Well, this is a very big demonstration. It's a demonstration which has been called by the opposition and the civil society group, which has just come under the umbrella of June 23rd movement. They have called the demonstration, and the demonstration is not only taking place in Dakar. It is currently taking place across the country in all major towns in Senegal. And they are saying that they are demonstrating because they want to make sure that the Constitutional Court will not, validate President Wade's candidacy.
Now, as I understand it, there is a government ban on these protests. Where does that stand now?
It didn't hold any water because the Minister of the Interior, Ousmane Gom, came out on air saying that demonstrations are banned. But what we saw today that, you know, people are still here in the obelisk place. Just imagine that where they have even prayed Friday prayers, and I'm sure they are going to pray here the sunset prayers as well, because their leader, Aliou Tine, said that they are not going to move, and then they are only waiting. If the Constitutional Court validates President Abdoulaye Wade, that means Senegal is sitting on a time bomb, that they are going to go out in the street and they are calling everybody to protest so that, you know, they will block this start for President Wade.
As you describe it, the protesters there have said that they will stay on the street until this decision comes from the court. The court is not only deciding on whether President Wade can run for a third term, but there are also other candidates that the court is deciding on. And if they can run, who are these other candidates that they're talking about?
Yes, the court is not looking at President Wade's candidacy. There's almost 20 presidential hopefuls who have already submitted their papers. So the Constitutional Court today, they have a lot of work to do. And people think that maybe by midnight they will come out with an announcement.
That's FSRN's Alpha Jallo in Dakar, Senegal. New details are emerging about the mortgage fraud working group that President Obama announced earlier this week in his State of the Union address. The group will investigate how mortgages were packaged over the past decade and prosecute any provable wrongdoing. The group is made up of state attorneys general, FBI agents, and federal officials from different agencies and held its first meeting today. They say they'll begin working immediately to secure relief for families facing foreclosure and hold the financial institutions accountable for their crimes. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
When the housing bubble burst in 2008, families lost their homes, People who invested in mortgage-backed securities lost their savings, and often their pensions, and the national economy plummeted into a recession. Speaking to reporters on Friday, Housing Secretary Sean Donovan laid out the extent of the damage caused by misconduct in the financial sector.
Mortgages were sold to people who couldn't afford or understand them. Banks made huge bets and bonuses with other people's money. And we all paid a very steep price. House prices sank for 30 straight months in a row. Foreclosures climbed to record levels month after month, and by the time the worst of it was over, our economy had lost 8 million jobs.
Now, a new working group will bring together state and federal agencies to begin to address the problem by speeding up investigations already begun in certain states and launching new ones where irresponsible lending has led to widespread foreclosures. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has been aggressively going after financial institutions in his own state for their misleading and predatory behavior, and says he's excited to kick off a national effort to do the same.
Collectively, we have jurisdiction to go after every aspect of the artificial inflation of the housing bubble and the mortgage-backed securities bubble and the crash that brought down the economy. We have jurisdiction over everything. We have the resources, and I assure you, we have the will.
As FSRN reported on Thursday, advocates for foreclosed families are protesting a national settlement deal with five major financial institutions over the issue of robo-signing, where mortgage company employees sign foreclosure notices without properly reviewing them. The state attorneys general of California, Massachusetts, New York, and Nevada recently rejected the terms of the settlement, saying it gave banks too much immunity from future prosecution and gave too little compensation to robo-signing victims. But Housing Secretary Donovan says a revised, more focused settlement deal leaves the door open for future investigation of those same banks and potentially charging them with crimes.
We would not be standing here today if we weren't absolutely confident that the releases that are being contemplated were quite narrow, focused on the conduct that was actually investigated. And those releases are narrow enough to allow us to go forward aggressively with what we're describing today.
Whether banks are still interested in paying billions for a settlement deal that doesn't protect them from prosecution is still up in the air. Shawnee Smith, who is currently battling foreclosure on the south side of Chicago, remains opposed to a settlement and hopes her state attorney general, Lisa Madigan, will refuse to sign.
I'm afraid that if they do sign the multi-state settlement, that it won't be enough. We really need a strong settlement, and we need something that is going to help rebuild our communities.
Smith says that because of predatory lending practices, including a company selling her a mortgage she didn't qualify for, and refusing to modify her loan when she lost her job, she may lose the family house where she was born and raised.
It truly has not only taken a toll on my family, but it has taken a toll on our community as a whole. So I'm just hoping that they will hold these banks accountable for how they have truly terrorized our communities.
As long as families continue to lose their homes, activists have vowed to keep advocating on their behalf. In Brooklyn, New York, on Thursday, demonstrators from Occupy Wall Street disrupted an auction of foreclosed homes. About 35 people were arrested at the action and continued to sing as they were handcuffed and escorted out of the courtroom. Both in Brooklyn and in cities across the country, activists have helped families reoccupy their foreclosed homes. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
The government of Iraq says it will take legal action on behalf of those killed by U.S. soldiers in the 2005 attack in Haditha. Earlier this week, manslaughter charges against U.S. Staff Sergeant Frank Wooderich were dismissed as the result of a plea deal. The November 2005 killing left 24 Iraqis dead, many of them unarmed civilians, including women and children. For more, we go to Baghdad to speak with freelance journalist Bashar Mandalawi. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
Witnesses to the killings described Sergeant Wooderich as the ringleader of the killings. Now with this plea deal, he has likely avoided any jail time. Talk about the significance of this decision.
Well, it's shock news. I do ask the military court to reconsider the judgment against the U.S. soldier who was baptized in doing his crime in cold blood. I do not believe that the American officers give orders to kill innocent people. This is not true. But someone there was playing real video games. But in the matter of fact, he killed real people. He must be brought to justice, real justice that fits the American democracy reputation. We have heard that the case is closed, but I think that Iraqi people say this is absolutely rejected.
Now, the Iraqi government has said that it will take legal action. What form could that take, and what options are available to them?
Well, we'll all do my respect. I don't think that our government will do just nothing. Because, and you're going to ask me why, and I will give you the reason. I mean, here, I'm as journalist, innocent people, innocent journalists get killed by some militias, and the government don't say no word, and they don't do any investigation. But what people of Haditha and Iraqi people needs from the United States to take an action again, it's to bring that person, that soldier, to justice, because I don't think that he received any order to kill innocent people. This is not what we heard about the United States, the state of democracy.
So you don't have a lot of confidence that the Iraqi government will take some concrete steps to bring some people involved to justice?
No, I really do reject this from the government, because I lost too many of my friends and the government. The Iraqi state did nothing about it.
This news comes, of course, just a month after the U.S. has officially withdrawn forces from Iraq. Has there been a noticeable change in safety when you go out into the neighborhoods? Has there been a change since U.S. has withdrawn forces?
I don't really want to give a very much black picture, but when I go outside, I don't feel I'm safe. For example, I've been forced to put a flag, a Shia Imam Hussein flag, because I live in some Shia neighborhood. I've been forced to put a flag. Otherwise, they will consider me as a Sunni, and then I will be under a circle of dangerous. It's not a situation, but it's not safe, not anymore. So I cannot expect that I may walk by some neighborhood and then I get killed by an explosion, unexpected one.
So there is still that fear of danger.
Exactly, too much.
Bashar Mendelawi is a freelance journalist based in Baghdad. He's also the projects manager with the Journalistic Freedoms Observatory. Bashar, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
A controversial proposal to mine iron ore near Lake Superior in Wisconsin got one step closer on Thursday. Amidst protests from environmentalists, native tribes, and concerned citizens, the Wisconsin State Assembly approved a bill to weaken environmental standards and support the construction of a huge new mine. Members of the public were removed from the room by police as lawmakers approved the measure. FSRN's Molly Stentz reports from Madison, Wisconsin.
The proposed mine would encompass a 22-mile stretch of the Pinoakee Iron Range in northern Wisconsin. It would be the largest in the state. Right now, it's hilly forest land, but in just a few short years, it could become a huge hole in the ground. Just a few miles down the road is a state park known for its waterfalls, and a few miles from that, Lake Superior, one of the largest freshwater lakes in the world. The would-be mine site also sits perched above one of the largest undeveloped coastal wetlands on the Upper Great Lakes, one locals call the Everglades of the North. But Republicans say this economically depressed region needs jobs, and they've written a new law to weaken environmental protections and pave the way for the mine. The mine developer, Gejebic Taconite CEO Bill Williams, says too much money is at stake to gamble on uncertainty from state regulators, and they needed new laws to make the project work.
We are a business that has to make investment decisions on a $1.5 billion project. We need to know the rules of the road. We need to know when we will have an answer, be it yes or be it no. We need to know when that answer is coming.
Republicans are anxious to create jobs in a state that has shown consistent job losses for the past 6 months. Republican Governor Scott Walker campaigned on creating a 250,000 new jobs in the state during his first year, which has not happened. Representative Jeff Fitzgerald, a powerful and influential leader in the Republican-controlled Assembly, says this mining bill would be the biggest jobs bill they'd see all year.
We know this will create hundreds of jobs when they're constructing the mine, generational jobs after the mine's in place. These aren't jobs that can pick up and go to China or India. The iron ore is in our ground here in Wisconsin.
But many area residents are Native American tribal members who have a long history of fighting and winning against mining companies. There are four federally recognized sovereign nations in the area. They have treaty rights that say the state of Wisconsin cannot legislate away their right to land and natural resources, which include clean drinking water and a productive wild rice crop. Nearly 100 Bad River Ojibwe and other tribal members drove across the state to converge upon the Capitol this week and make that message heard. Bad River Chair Mike Wiggins Jr. says the environmental costs of the proposed mine are too high to bear, and they're prepared to sue if the mine and legislation go through.
Mining companies will be able to dump toxic mine waste into sensitive wetlands and floodplains. We're against that. It would allow the mining company to draw down water levels from rivers, lakes, and streams, groundwater aquifers. We're against that. It would allow mining corporations to contaminate groundwater and then to be off the hook if that contamination is actually deeper than 1,000 feet. Bad River's against that.
Tribal members question whether a temporary economic boost is worth the price of an industry that could forever change the ecosystem. Glenn Stoddard, an attorney for many of the tribes in northern Wisconsin, says the area's land, water, and food sources have supported Native peoples for centuries.
If all the mining proposals in the world right now at this time are granted, we will have more mining in the next 20 years than has ever been done in human history. These mines are huge, they are mechanized, and the jobs are few. Once that hole is dug and once those wetlands are gone and the streams are running backwards into a cesspool of pollution, there's no way to reverse it. There's only way to mitigate it.
Some residents in northern Wisconsin had been hopeful about the project, according to Democrat Janet Bewley, who represents the district where the mine is proposed. But she says they're not willing to accept it without safeguards for the environment and public health. She skewered Assembly Republicans at the Capitol for using her constituents as pawns in political theater.
If this is really about jobs, why didn't you write a good bill? You could have done it. We could have all won.
The mining legislation now heads to the state Senate, which Republicans control by one vote. Senate leadership wants a bill passed by March, but several Republican senators have said they're still undecided. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
Board members with Hollywood's top unions will meet over the weekend to decide whether or not to approve a plan to merge. The deal is between the Screen Actors Guild and the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. This follows last week's tentative pact by the group for one union, made up of leaders from both sides, to form a single entity. The merger promises to strengthen union membership, but not everyone thinks that bigger is better. FSRN's Leilani Albano has the story.
If passed, the merger would combine 70,000 journalists, broadcasters, disc jockeys, singers, and dancers from the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, or AFTRA, and 125,000 members of the Screen Actors Guild, or SAG, making it the largest entertainment union in Hollywood. SAG members are expected to ratify the merger agreement, ending a long-standing rift with AFTRA over differing bargaining strategies and philosophies. The union's efforts to unite reflect a growing consensus in Hollywood that a merger is needed in order to bargain with powerful media companies, SAG member Christian Mioli.
With the idea of SAG and AFTRA coming together as one, there is more of a sense that we will have a stronger representation against a powerful producer base, which is backed by multi-conglomerates who really could care less about the local actor.
The merger comes during a time of serious economic turmoil for SAG members. While unemployment rates among union members have always been unusually high, entertainment jobs have been harder to come by thanks to the ailing economy and reality television taking over much of the airwaves. Muffy Sunday is a member of the Communications Workers of America and an organizer with the Freedom Socialist Party.
They're desperate for jobs, and they are probably being convinced that this is a way that they will unite and then organize reality TV.
The unions could not be reached for an on-air comment. However, in a statement, the presidents of SAG and AFTRA said the merger is something to be proud of. But not all SAG members support the deal, including Alexis Kiley.
I really hope it does not go through.
She says it's unfair that AFTRA members are not required to meet the same stringent requirements as SAG members to become part of the union.
It's bombarding SAG with people who really don't take acting as serious as SAG members do.
According to the SAG website, the proposal includes a blueprint for a membership constitution, governing structure, and a dues plan for workers. However, no other details were included. That has left Kiley with lingering questions.
But a number one for most SAG members is the pensions. What's going to happen to the actors that invested time, into their pensions? Does it freeze when the AFTRA members come into SAG? Is that going to freeze and then they're going to have to start all over again? It's a bit scary when it's unknown charted land.
Communications Workers of America member Sunday agrees and says a lack of transparency raises concerns about the contract.
You would think that in a big thing like this, you'd get a sheet of paper that says, we've prepared an argument, this is yes and no, and let you decide. If there's not even that in there, on what basis would a member vote yes?
This isn't the first time that the unions tried to merge. There were attempts to combine SAG and AFTRA in 2003, but SAG members voted against it. Sunday says their relationship worsened in 2008. That's when AFTRA ended its decades-long bargaining partnership with SAG and negotiated separate primetime contracts with the Producers Association, the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers.
AFTRA walked out with no warning and declared that they were open for business to negotiate with management and signed what I would consider a sweetheart agreement, including none of the protections that were being asked for in negotiations, and of course was rewarded with lots of contracts for new TV shows.
That deal had an impact, says SAG member Mioli, one which led to a major downturn in wages and benefits for SAG members.
For a majority of people, it became a bit more difficult over the last few years, making a living in show business.
The 2008 agreement may have riled SAG members, but it also sparked talks with AFTRA to form a single union as a way to increase its negotiating clout.
There's power in numbers. When we can come to the table, the negotiating table, as one union, we will have a stronger say.
But Sunday thinks differently. She says it will take mass organizing and not just big numbers for the two unions to negotiate a winning contract.
So I think it's not so much whether the union is big or if it is merged, it's whether or not it is willing to fight. And if it's not, you can be as big as you want and you're not going to fight.
Members from SAG and AFTRA are expected to vote on the merger plan sometime in April. The merger will take effect only if 60% of those who vote support the measure. Leilani Albano, FSRN Los Angeles.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Shauna Ray. Thanks for listening today and have a good weekend. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.